All right, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Federalist Society, welcome. My name is Louis Capozzi. I'm a steering committee member of the Philadelphia Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. A proud graduate of Penn Law, I'm a law clerk at the United States Court of Appeals, and I will be clerking at the Supreme Court during the 2021 term. It is my pleasure to be one of your hosts tonight. Before getting started, I'd like to acknowledge some people that made tonight's event possible. First, I'd like to thank Allison Keener, counsel to U.S. Attorney Bill McSwain, who helped plan this event from start to finish. Second, I'd like to thank our chapter president, Matt Hank, whose steady leadership kept our planning on track. Third, I'd like to thank our chapter vice president, Steve Lee, who ensured that Pennsylvania's CLE credit will be available for tonight's event. The attendance code for CLE will be announced at the start of the audience question and answer period, so please stay tuned. Fourth, I would like to thank all our co-sponsoring chapters, the Pittsburgh Lawyers Chapter, the New Jersey Lawyers Chapter, the Delaware Lawyers Chapter, the Harrisburg Lawyers Chapter, and the Penn Law Student Chapter. Finally, I'd like to thank Lisa Izzell, Jenny Mahoney, and all the great people at the National Federalist Society office. For those unfamiliar with the Federalist Society, it is a group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. If you are interested in getting more involved, don't hesitate to reach out. Let's turn to tonight's topic, the 2020 elections and the future of election law. After years of breathless media coverage, we thought it would be prudent to pause and think about what we have learned, focusing on the future of election law. Where do we go now? It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's all-star panel. First, Hans von Spakovsky is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He is also the manager of the think tank's Election Law Reform Initiative. Previously, he was a member of the Federal Election Commission, counsel to the Assistant Attorney General of the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, and an election official in both Virginia and Georgia. President Trump also appointed him to the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity in 2017. Second, Jerry Goldfeder is special counsel at Struke, Struke & Levon, LLP. He has practiced election law for over 40 years, representing a variety of high-level elected officials, including a mayor, a governor, and a president. He currently is chair of the New York State Bar Association's 2020 Presidential Task Force, which has advised on legal issues involved in the recent presidential race. He is also an adjunct professor of law at Fordham Law School, and he has also taught election law at Penn Law School. Third, Harmeet Dhillon is the principal of the Dhillon Law Group, where she practices in a wide variety of areas, including election law. Most recently, she served as a legal advisor to the Trump campaign and was also co-chair of Women for Trump. She is the co-chair of the Republican National Lawyers Association. Active in California politics, she has been a leader in the California Republican Party and served as a member of the Republican National Committee. She regularly appears on Fox News. And finally, it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Professor Michael Moreland. At Villanova Law School, he is University Professor of Law and Religion and Director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy. He has been on the Villanova faculty since 2006. Before that, he served as Associate Director for Domestic Policy at the White House under President George W. Bush, where he worked on a range of legal policy issues, including criminal justice, Immigration, Civil Rights, and Liability Reform. Professor Moreland, take it away.
Thank you very much, Lou. It's welcome, everyone, and a very good evening from the snowy suburbs of Philadelphia, where I am. It's a pleasure to be moderating this very timely and important discussion, especially with such a distinguished group of participants. Just a word about the structure of the evening, and then I'll turn it over for some opening remarks from our panelists. They will each take about 10 minutes to give some opening remarks on topics that they think are most interesting and compelling about this issue that we're speaking about this evening. And then we will have about 15 or 20 minutes or so of discussion that I will ask some questions. They can ask questions of each other. And then we'll turn it over at the end for questions from you, the audience. As we go along, but at any time, starting with their own opening remarks, but during the Q&A, what I will do is I will look at the Q&A box. If you look at the bottom of your Zoom screen, you see Q&A there, and you can pose questions there, and I will kind of collect them, maybe synthesize some of them if there are commonalities among some of the questions that people are asking, and pose them to our panelists. And again, as Lou said, I will give the CLE code word at the beginning of our audience Q&A, and we'll try to wrap up right promptly at 7 o'clock. So in order, we will hear from Mr. Von Spakovsky, and then Mr. Goldfeder, and then Ms. Dillon. And so with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Von Spakovsky for his opening statement.
Thank you, Professor. And I want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to be here, and also thank Jared and Harmeet also for participating in this panel. And I have to say, one of the best things about the Federalist Society is it provides a forum for civil debate, even over controversial issues. And that is a rarity these days when often contentious issues cannot be debated in a civil manner, which I think is actually a hallmark of the American democratic system. You know, when I was talking to Lou about this, you know, one of the things he wanted us to talk about was what was a good thing that came out of this election and what were bad things that came out of this election. Look, one of the best things that has come out of this election, I think, is we had very high turnout. You know, people are always concerned about turnout going down in the United States, problems with people being interested in elections. And just to give you some very quick figures, these are all from the United States Election Project. Okay, this is a project at the University of Florida. It has some of the most accurate turnout information in the country because their turnout rates are based on the voting eligible population. Turnout figures that you see based on the voting age population are usually inaccurate. The advantage of what the United States Election Project does is by basing turnout on the voting eligible population, what they do is they take the voting age population and they subtract out individuals who are not eligible to vote, like non-citizens and felons, for example, who've not yet had their right to vote returned. And to give an example of this, in 2008, we had record turnout in the election when Barack Obama got elected. In fact, it was the highest turnout since the early 1960s in the presidential election, 61.6%. In this election, the latest numbers that I just checked, they're projecting a turnout of 66.6%, 5 percentage points more than in 2008. So, you know, that's a good thing. People were interested in this election and they turned out to vote. One of the bad things that I think we've seen in this election, quite frankly, is when half of the electorate, and the polling shows us, when half of the electorate believes that there was misconduct and other problems in the election and that their vote may not have been counted, that is a bad thing. I think everyone agrees. The Supreme Court has said this. The Carter-Baker Commission back in 2005 has said that we want to maintain, it's very important to maintain, public confidence in the election process. And we don't want people questioning the outcome because they don't trust the system. We want an election system in which at the end of the day, when the winner is announced, everyone, including the candidates who lost, and the voters whose candidate didn't win, all say, well, you know, my candidate lost, but it was a fair process. And there was no cheating or misconduct or errors by election officials that caused a problem. Now, I think another big problem we saw in this election was what I believe was a unneeded push to get everyone to vote by absentee ballot all over the country. Early elections, particularly in Wisconsin, elsewhere, showed that you could vote safely in person. In fact, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, this summer issued guidelines on how to do that safely. And as long as polling places followed the same kind of safety protocols we all see when we're going out to grocery stores, et cetera, people could vote safely in person with social distancing, masks, the cleaning of voting booths before and after voters use them. The reason I say it was a bad idea to push folks towards absentee balloting is because if you look at past elections, and the New York Times, by the way, wrote a great article about this 8 years ago, absentee ballots have always had a higher rejection rate than the ballots of people cast in person. The reason for that is straightforward. You know, when a voter is filling out an absentee ballot in their home, there's no one there, no election officials to answer their questions. And that's why they have a higher rejection rate. Everything from voters forgetting to sign ballots to not providing all the information needed to the ballots being delivered late. So pushing everyone to vote by absentee ballots, I think, was not a good idea. And obviously, we need absentee ballots for people who can't make it to the polls, for individuals who are too sick or disabled to do that. But I think that was not a good idea, and I don't think it was needed. Second, look, there were a lot of lawsuits and there were a lot of actions by executive branch officials in state governments to change the rules governing elections, frankly, in the middle of the process. And I think it is actually the campaign and others are correct in the fact that the Constitution very clearly gives the power to set the rules for presidential elections to state legislatures, not state government. And Pennsylvania is a good example of that. As you know, the deadline for the receipt of absentee ballots in Pennsylvania, according to state law, was Election Day. Yet the Secretary of State came in and said, well, I'm overriding state law and we're going to accept absentee ballots for 3 days after the election. They did that with the approval of the state Supreme Court. And so they changed the rules of it, basically in the middle of the election, but in an unconstitutional manner. No one questions that if the state legislature had wanted to change the law for those rules to be in place, it could have done so. And that's the proper way to do it, because the state legislature is the collective representatives of the voters, not one official within the state government making that kind of decision. And what folks need to understand about that, and that the danger of that for future elections, is that if executive branch officials can on their own simply override a state statute, then you may in the future have governors or secretaries of state and other people who are partisan elected officials changing rules in a way that they think might help candidates of their political party. And that's a danger that we would face potentially from both Democratic and Republican officials. And it was just a very bad idea, and frankly, I think a violation of the Constitution to be changing rules in the middle of the election, particularly because many of those rules were intended to weaken the security protocols governing absentee ballots. Everything from getting rid of signature verification, which is one of the few ways of making sure that the absentee ballot submitted by a voter is actually that of the voter himself or herself, to trying to get rid of witness signature requirements and other measures, all intended to safeguard the security of the absentee balloting process. The other problem that we saw in this election was, look, in every single state, we have state laws that make it a requirement and make it legal for candidates and political parties to have observers in every aspect of the election process. This kind of transparency is essential to having secure and fair elections. We want the candidates for all the political parties And we want the political parties themselves to have observers in the polling places, in areas where the central counting is going, because that helps assure everyone involved that the law is being followed and nothing is being improperly done. And yet we had numerous instances, Detroit, Philadelphia, and other areas where observers were kept out or locked out, for example, of the central counting locations. Again, this should not be a partisan issue. That kind of transparency is essential. That's why our State Department sends observers to fledgling democracies all over the world to protect the democratic process. That's why just prior to the election, I was asked to brief 100 observers from the EU who were here to observe our elections. And that's the kind of thing we cannot allow that to happen. And by the way, it of course raises questions in the minds of the public, because they're sitting there saying, well, why would they do that? What was going on behind closed doors that would cause them to keep the observers out? So I think there are all kinds of changes that we need to make to ensure, for example, that this kind of transparency violations doesn't happen again. I think we need to make changes to assure the security of the absentee balloting process. And one final thing that all of us as lawyers should be concerned about. Look, it is an obligation of our profession to represent our clients to the best of our abilities. And we do that even sometimes when we don't like the clients that we have. People in private practice particularly know that. Yet the threats that have been lodged against lawyers representing the Trump campaign are really outrageous. I mean, the latest that I saw were two things. One, the lawyer who was representing one of the lawyers representing the Trump campaign in Philadelphia, who I happen to know, her name is Linda Kern, had to go to the court for a protective order because an associate at a law firm, Kirkland & Ellis, that was defending the Secretary of State in that law firm, called her up and made all kinds of outrageous comments to her, criticizing her for representing the campaign. Kirkland and Ellis has asked to withdraw from that lawsuit, but so far I have not seen that they've apologized for the behavior of their associate or taken any disciplinary action against their associate. Also, a congressman from New Jersey, James Pascrell, has actually written a letter to the Pennsylvania Bar Association asking that they investigate and discipline Ms. Kearns and other lawyers simply for representing their clients in court. This should outrage everyone. I don't care whether you support the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, or anybody else. All of us should be protesting over this kind of behavior because that is just outrageous that is happening. And I have not heard the kind of criticism of that we should all be voicing. Thanks.
Thank you. And with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Goldfeder.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's good to be with fellow members of the bar here. I should say up front, I'm not a member of the Federalist Society. I'm a member of the American Constitution Society. And in my capacity as an adjunct professor of election law, both at Fordham Law School and Penn Law, I've organized many a panel and participated in many a panel with lawyers and law professors from both Federal Society and ACS in the interest of trying to have a conversation about legal issues that affect all of us. I've had the privilege of representing in a variety of ways both Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and I worked on the Biden campaign as well. That said, I didn't realize that there were going to be these kinds of partisan statements that I just heard. And so I just want to briefly address some of the statements that my friend just made. with regard to the Pennsylvania situation, he may think it what was done in Pennsylvania was unconstitutional, but no court thought that extending the receipt of absentee ballots was anything to do with security issues in any way, compromised security issues, and no court found that it was unconstitutional to extend the time when the Board of Elections could actually receive a ballot. Fortunately, the number of ballots that were received in that three-day period did make a difference one way or another. If that had occurred, and if Pennsylvania was the key state in the election, then maybe the Supreme Court might have ruled on the merits of that case, but fortunately it wasn't. And therefore, some people may think that it was improper to have done so, and they're entitled to view it in that way, but no court has found that. And certainly, no one has questioned the extension of the receipt of ballots as having anything to do with the security of absentee ballots as a general rule, whether they need to be signed and verified in any way. They did need to be signed and verified in exactly the same way as every other absentee ballot, because it related to the receipt of the ballots, not when they were actually filled out. They were all filled out before Election Day. The second point that I want to respond to, unfortunately, is I really don't think there was a real issue with regard to observers except for one or two places. Everybody wants observers. The law requires observers, and I think everybody had the opportunity to observe the counting of the ballots. And certainly that was never ruled to be an issue by any court, even though there were so many cases that were brought. And as long as he brought up the subject with regard to that, with regard to alleged fraud, we saw case after case after case after case where there was no fraud adduced, and there was no fraud found. And so I think as a general proposition, we have to be thankful for the fact that state election officials and local election officials throughout the country did their job. There was a repeated findings of no fraud, and the results were sufficiently clear that these lawsuits signed on by so many Congress people and attorneys general throughout the United States to overturn the actual results were just dismissed out of hand. And I think that if there is one worry that we ought to have, is not that the election did not run smoothly, when all is said and done, it did, is that as a professor said, that the issue of peaceful succession is so important in this country. This was our 59th presidential election. We've never had a situation where a candidate or his supporters have refused to accept the results, and attorneys general and members of Congress have refused to accept the results and have alleged all sorts of activity that for which there was never any proof. So having said all of that, what I really wanted to address, and I will address in a few minutes, is that one of the fortunate results of this campaign, no matter what side you were on, is that the results were pretty clear. That the margins were comfortable in every state, such that we did not have to rely on a small margin in one or two states to determine who was elected. And the reason that's so important is that if it were closer, then some of the laws that we have may have broken down. What I mean specifically is this. The Constitution, as he rightly said, the Constitution gives the authority to the legislatures to decide how electors are going to be chosen. This was done 232 years ago. It's a system that we may not like, we may like. We are at this point stuck with it. We've had, as I say, 59 presidential elections based upon this framework. The Constitution gives to Congress the power to set the date of when electors are chosen, and it gives Congress the power to set the date when the electors would meet. It doesn't give Congress any more power than that. Nevertheless, in 1876, when we had this very contentious election, probably the most contentious election in our history, as a result of it, we enacted the Electoral Count Act, which has a variety of provisions that were put into place in case there was a close election, so that we would have rules in advance in order to understand how we would sort out who won in a state and who didn't win. They didn't have all these laws in effect in 1876, and so it was very problematic. They established this extra constitutional commission. So as a result of that election, in the 1880s, we enacted what we currently have, this Electoral Count Act. Whether or not Congress really had the constitutional authority to enact these rules, to me, is an open question. And you don't have to be a liberal or a conservative to raise that as an issue. So there's just a few provisions in this act that I want to raise that fortunately did not have to come into play because we didn't have a close election in one state whereby it would matter how these laws were interpreted and implemented. But nevertheless, we could have that at some point in the future. There's a particular provision, it's 3 U.S.C. 2, that says if a state fails to make a choice on election day, then the state legislature shall essentially remedy, I'm obviously paraphrasing, remedy the situation by to make certain that the state has electors. Makes sense. I'm not sure it's constitutional for the Congress to have enacted this, but it makes some sense to do that. And so what does that mean? What does it mean if a state fails to make a choice? Well, before the election, I was very worried about all those absentee ballots in Pennsylvania that Hans was talking about. I was concerned that the entire election would come down to Pennsylvania. And the entire election would come down to all these absentee ballots. And it would take a year and a day to count all these absentee ballots. And there'd be litigation about these absentee ballots. I was concerned about that. And anybody who was paying attention was also probably concerned about that. And if that occurred, then we might not have had a result for many, many weeks. And 3 U.S.C. 2 might have been invoked. The provision that says if the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania had failed to make a choice, as in we don't know who won, then the legislature can remedy that. And what that might have meant was, even though the legislature of Pennsylvania, like the legislature in every other state, has had laws on their books for 144 years that say voters go to the polls and voters choose, electors pledge to Biden, electors pledge to Trump. If there was a question as to who won, and 3 USC 2 was invoked, that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania had failed to make a choice, we didn't know who won, the legislature might have attempted to step in and choose its own slate of electors. Florida almost did that in the year 2000, but as a result of Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court ruling, the work done by the legislature in Florida and the governor of the state, Jeb Bush, was shelved because it wasn't necessary. The Supreme Court essentially ended the election. But if we had this problem this year, could the legislature have, after Election Day, after a certain period of time, made a determination as to whether or not we knew who won in that state? Would it have been constitutional for the legislature to step in and choose its own slate of electors because it decided that the state had, quote unquote, failed to make a choice? Number one, what does failed to make a choice mean? Number two, when can that determination be made? And number three, who makes the determination as to whether or not there has been a failure to make a choice? Thank goodness we did not have that problem. But if we did have that problem in a very tight election, like we almost had that problem in 2000, were it not for the fact that the Supreme Court intervened, was involved, and made a determination which both sides accepted, we would have had a contentious litigation relating to what the legislature of Pennsylvania might have done, invoking their so-called authority under 3 USC 2 of this Electoral Count Act. So I'm not sure that that would have been appropriate for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to invoke that act. And I'm not certain what the Supreme Court of the United States would have done, but it would have caused the kind of constitutional crisis that we all would like to avoid. Let me address one other piece of the electoral, another provision of the Electoral Count Act, which is 3 USC 15. Again, we'll talk about Pennsylvania. 64 state legislators in Pennsylvania have written to their congressional delegation saying, we need to object to the electors, the Biden electors from Pennsylvania, even though they've already voted. And as many of you know who are listening tonight, the statute says if one representative and one senator object to a slate of electors, then the House and Senate shall decide the bona fides of those electors. And now, as we sit here tonight, I think this process is still going on. There's still an effort to object to these electors. And if that occurs, 3 USC 15 says we have to have this kind of procedure to have an objection to those electors. But both the House and Senate voting separately have to make a determination. And 3 USC 15 says if the House and Senate don't agree, and under the politics in which we live, the House and Senate wouldn't agree, the House is Democratic, and even if the Senate remains Republican, they're not going to, they potentially would not agree. I suspect that they would both reject the objection. But if they didn't, if the House turned down the objection to the Pennsylvania electors, and the Senate, for some reason, decided to accept the objection electors, then I'm going to finish up right now. Then the law says that it's up to the governor. Whatever the governor, whichever slate the governor has certified, shall be determinative as to whether or not the electors are bona fide. Now, taking partisanship out of it, if any legislature and governor are on opposite sides of the aisle, and the objection is pressed by members of the Congress, then how do we get to a place where what a governor has done, what a governor has signed off on, becomes determinative as to a slate of electors, whether or not they're valid, when the premise of the constitutional provision is that the legislature shall decide how electors are chosen, and in fact, the voters have gone to the polls and chosen those electors. So my point here, my overall point, is that fortunately, we did not have a close election. Because if we had, there are so many people who are still challenging the results, that if we had a close election, that the laws that we have in place wouldn't really work. And I think the lesson here is that we need to reform the Electoral Count Act that's been put into place over 100 years ago, so that if we do have a close election, then we don't have to worry about partisanship. Then we have set rules that make sense in order to make a decision as to what the people of the states have done when they've gone to the polls and voted for president. I apologize for taking more time than I was allotted, but I turn it back over to you.
Thank you. And with that, I'll turn over to Ms. Dillon. Go ahead. You need to unmute yourself. Yeah.
Much, Professor Moreland, and thank you to my fellow panelists, and thank you to the Federalist Society for allowing us to talk about this very topical and important topic. I am a partisan. I was the national co-chair of Lawyers for Trump, and I serve in a volunteer capacity with the campaign. I also have filed lawsuits in this election cycle on behalf of the Republican National Committee in my own state to make sure the president was on the ballot successfully, and some other litigation. So I come at this perspective from somebody who has a passion for the rule of law, and I feel like we have done a few things right in this election cycle and a lot of things wrong. So in the short amount of time that I have, I'm going to try to hit the high points, and maybe we can talk more during the discussion. So what did we do right? What worked in this election cycle? Well, contrary to popular opinion, I think in-person voting worked very well during this election season, despite the fact of the pandemic. And the CDC issued guidelines in this election saying that it was safe for people to vote in person. And in fact, it was so safe that supposedly, even if you had a live COVID-19 infection, but you were taking all appropriate considerations regarding masking, social distancing, et cetera, you could vote safely in person in the 2020 election and all would be well. The only people who made the assertion, the extreme assertion that no in-person voting was appropriate was actually Democrat partisans. Mark Elias made the extraordinary remark, for example, that requiring people voting in person in Wisconsin 1 week before the election, everybody would die. And yet days later made the argument that if we did not expand in-person voting in Nevada, we would be violating the Constitution and democracy would die. So there were a lot of extreme positions taken there, but overall, many people voted in person. Most people voted by mail, and in and of itself, voting in person worked pretty well. I would say Florida worked well in this election cycle. After being the problem child of our last, heavily contested election, Florida really did clean up its act, and the election went very well in Florida. This is the importance of improved and clear election laws, as demonstrated in Florida. The places that were a problem as recently as 2018 in Florida, Broward County, had terrible officials who were replaced in after that election cycle, and with with linear officials who followed the laws written, we had a great outcome and an orderly outcome and a result on election night. And I would have to respectfully disagree with my fellow panelist, Mr. Goldfeder, concerning the rapidity with which we received results in this election. I think the fact that we have taken several weeks to receive results straggling in and all these election contests and so forth, and even counting taking weeks. I live with this in California. In California, it is now the norm for it to take 30 days to finish an election because the law allows it. Guess what? Bureaucrats expand to take all of those 30 days to make sure that every vote is counted, and maybe they find some. The counting keeps, for the Republicans, the WAG is the counting keeps going on until the Democrats find the votes to win. I'm not saying that is true. I'm just saying that when you have elections going on and on and on, it can undermine integrity, respect for the integrity of the outcome. And I don't think that's a good thing. And I give the example of the Brexit vote in the UK. In the UK, I think they had a very high turnout. I believe it was almost 40 million votes that were cast. And within an hour after the ballots, after the polls closed, we had a result in that election. And so, that is efficient. That is perhaps how we should be aiming to do our elections in the future. That didn't happen this time. And I think that's problematic. So what did not work? So many things did not work in this election, and some of those things did not work in prior elections, and some of them were unique to this election. I think first and foremost, that does not work when you're doing an increasing number of mail-in balloting, which is something Democrats pushed before the election. So as any of you who are following this issue will know, that Nancy Pelosi's first piece of legislation in 2019 was H.R. 1. H.R. 1 included a package of laws that in many ways mirror the terrible laws we have in California, in my opinion. That did not succeed, but it turns out through the COVID door, if you will, a lot of these laws that I don't like have actually become the norm in many of our states. And some of them are likely to stay for various reasons that are political on the ground in each of these states. But number one problem with all mail balloting is when you don't have clean voter rolls. This is a disaster where, for example, in California, where I live, we have one county, Los Angeles County, with 25% of the population of the state, 10 million people. And in recent litigation in Los Angeles County, it was found that over a million people on the rolls there were dead, were duplicates, had moved out of the state, or were felons presently not entitled to vote. That's a lawsuit that Judicial Watch brought, resulting in a settlement that agreed that over time, they would clear up these roles. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have Georgia, where Governor Kemp, when he was the attorney general there, attempted to utilize existing voter roll cleanup requirements under the National Voter and under the NVRA. And under NVRA, it's a duty of the states to clean up the voter rolls. And so when he tried to do that, Stacey Abrams cried foul, and there was a lot of drama over that. And frankly, Georgia did not press hard enough, in my opinion, to keep up that push for integrity. So how does that play out? Well, there are some states in the United States that have had all-mail balloting for years: Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and Utah. They all successfully have implemented all-mail balloting, but it is coupled with cleaning their voter rolls. It is coupled with education. It is coupled with a lot of investment in infrastructure that makes the voters trust that that is a good system. None of that was in place in the rest of the country, where I think prematurely elected officials decided to spam the populace with ballots. And we have received numerous reports in states of people receiving multiple ballots, people receiving ballots for people who don't live there. In COVID, we have heard of thousands of ballots being sent to college towns where the students are actually studying remotely. Does that mean fraud occurred? No, it does not mean fraud occurred. Fraud would only occur if the ballot is then voted by somebody who received it. So the point is that with the potential for fraud, you have a commensurate decrease in confidence of the outcome of the election. And when you have a close election, which we did have a close election in some states, you have serious concerns. So I think reform is needed to make sure that in future elections, we place a high degree of emphasis, Democrat or Republican, in cleaning those voter rolls, because that's really important for the integrity of election, whether it is in-person balloting or mail balloting. Transparency is a huge problem in this election cycle. Again, I respectfully disagree with my colleague here on this panel, where you have a law in Pennsylvania, for example, that says all that it says, and this is terrible drafting on the part of the legislators, a Republican legislature, I might add, where it says, you know, observers can be in the room. Well, what does that mean? Some of my friends were actually using binoculars, standing on chairs from a great distance to be able to see what exactly is going on in a football field-sized room in terms of checking what's happening. That is a meaningless observation, right? You even had the hypothetical posed in one of the multiple Pennsylvania litigations as to whether it would be appropriate for election officials to put a curtain up around the tables that were where the ballots were being counted. Would that meet the statutory standard of observers in the room? And, you know, from the questions from the court, I think the answer would have been yes, which is, of course, ridiculous. That is a meaningless transparency there. So I think reform is needed. And this is, again, a bipartisan problem. It's a Republican legislature that passed that terrible law. These laws need to be changed in multiple states. We have a problem with changing chain of custody of mail ballots. It is meaningless, frankly, if you have clean voter rolls, you have really good integrity on that end, but then you don't have an appropriate chain of custody of the ballots. And now I am not saying I buy into these theories that these unmarked vans drove up and, you know, hundreds of thousands of ballots came in through the back door. I have no evidence of that. But the fact that you don't have good chain of custody, I mean, today's day and age, I have scanning of everything. Like, you have scanning of your card to get a coffee at Starbucks. Why don't we have better use of technology to make sure that chain of custody is there? That would increase integrity of elections. Unmonitored drop boxes. So in this mail-in balloting situation, we had states like California that had drop boxes on the street outside registrars of voters' offices. One of those drop boxes was set on fire. Is that a good control of our ballots, that people can break into them, steal them, or set them on fire? I would submit that as a failure. I think a huge problem in this election cycle has been differential treatment of ballots in different counties in the same state. So, for example, Georgia had this problem. Pennsylvania had this problem. If you have such great discretion amongst the election officials that somebody can count a ballot in one county if it is a mail-in ballot but missing an address, missing, you know, that where the signature doesn't match, yet in another county, using Mr. Von Spakovsky's example of the fact that you know, we have typically 3%, sometimes higher rejection rates. In the New York primary, it was almost 20% rejection of mail-in balloting. And yet all of a sudden that rejection rate drops to 1/100th of that amount. Yet in the neighboring county, it's still 3%. That means that a lot of ballots were counted that are defective according to state law in one county, but they were not counted in the next county. And guess what? The cleavage amongst those counties as to where they fell, one side or the other, was a partisan cleavage. And so I think that's a problem. So we need to have statewide norms. Right now in Georgia, with the runoff election coming up, this is a big dispute between the candidates on the Republican side and their Republican Secretary of State. There is a demand from the state party to issue uniform guidelines and from the candidates to issue uniform guidelines. And the Secretary of State has seemed to be reticent to do that because of litigation that he has been defending from the Democrat side. Mail ballot curing is another area where if you have differential treatment. For example, if you have activist groups that are, you know, really partisan groups in drag that are given access to information regarding defective ballots, whereas, you know, the general public is not given that information, you can have mail ballot curing where somebody goes and chases that signature, chases that address, makes sure missing information is filled in. If that is done on a partisan basis, And you know, you have no integrity in that election cycle. So this is a problem that we need to fix. Last minute election rule changes are a huge problem here. This should not be a game of billionaires. This should not be, elections should not be a situation where the person with the most money to go in and file lawsuits and lobby for last minute rule changes is the one who wins the election. Yet in state after state, we had last minute rule changes in 2020. In Nevada, there were radical rule changes less than 90 days from the general election. 16 states postponed their primary elections this year, sometimes on the eve, as in Ohio, on the eve of the election. Uncertainty regarding rules concerning ongoing litigation. Litigation was done very much at the last minute, and I blame both parties for this. I blame my own party for this in a way. Some challenges that perhaps should have been brought in a more timely manner or brought before the election were not brought in a timely manner or not brought before the election. I think people were asleep at the wheel regarding the integrity of some of these voting machines. And again, I am not saying, just to be clear, that the cold dead hand of Hugo Chavez came down and changed the outcome of our 2020 election. However, I am saying that Democrats expressed a lot of concern about these Dominion or other brand voting machines, whatever they are. These include Elizabeth Warren and others. And so I think that this is a big issue that's going to face some legislative reform, hopefully. And I know we're running out of time. I have a list of other issues, but I think finally what I would say is, to me, the biggest losers here in this outcome is public loss of respect for the integrity of the outcome of the election. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say millions of Americans, and I do not mean the deplorables that we hear Democrats talk about. I mean millions of people who are thinking, intelligent, patriotic Americans who accepted Barack Obama as their president. People are concerned that we did not have a fair election here, more so than any time in my adult life. And so these are things we need to work on together, both parties, to make sure that citizens on both sides do have confidence in the outcome of the election. If we do not have this, we will have civil unrest in this country, and that is to be avoided at all costs. So with that, I'll conclude, and hopefully we can have a discussion in the limited time we have left.
If I may, Ms. Dillon, I appreciate much of your remarks. You know, as you know, and many people listening know, that Bush v. Gore stands for the proposition that the recount in Florida in the year 2000 violated the equal protection rights under the Constitution, because there was different methods being employed in the various counties, just the kind of issue that you addressed. And I think it's the real problem. And it's not just Republican versus Democrat. It happens in primaries all the time, in my experience, as well. And I'm a firm believer that there should be transparency, and there should be consistency from one county to the next. And I also believe that there should be consistency from one state to the next. What people learned, they learn this every 4 years, but they forget about it. Election lawyers remember all these details, but most normal people don't, that every state has so many different laws with regard to who can vote and what the procedures are and so on. Would you agree with me that it might be useful to explore a standardized set of laws with regard to federal elections, Congress enacting in a bipartisan way a set of laws that every state, and therefore, of course, the counties within the state, have to abide by, so that we don't have this hodgepodge of laws? And frankly, if we did have that, we would eliminate so much of the litigation that we saw this year, and we would, I would think, increase the confidence that people have in the election, because we'd have a uniform standard. It would still be regulated by the states, the elections, but one standard might solve a lot of the problems that you've addressed. How do you feel about that?
Harmeet, before answering that, if I could just interject quickly, we will go a little bit past 7 o'clock, not long. I do want, though, to be sure to give the CLE word for those seeking CLE credit, and that CLE word is consequences. The CLE word is consequences.
That's appropriate.
We are going slightly over, but I did, to pick up on Jerry's question maybe about it, I thought maybe to roll that together with some questions also that have been asked in the Q&A function, given that I do think it's important that we kind of have the, you know, the discussion focused not on what went right, what went wrong, but on potential reforms for the future. So I guess I would roll Jerry's question to Hans and Harmeet maybe about a uniform federal statute for election integrity, along with a question that was raised in the Q&A about a national voter ID law as well. And so if maybe Hans and Harmeet, if you could very briefly kind of...
Harmeet, if you don't mind me going first, because unfortunately I've got a 7 o'clock deadline, so I'm going to have to get off. As I told you earlier, look, the problem with this federal standardization is that for everything that could be done well, there are plenty of things that could be done bad. And the best example of that is what Harmeet mentioned earlier, which was H.R. 1. H.R. 1 would have been it basically proposed a federalization and takeover of the administration elections across the country. And there were two particular provisions in it that would have been terrible from an election integrity standpoint. One would have been basically a ban on all of the voter ID laws that have been passed in states like Georgia, Alabama, and Texas. And second, there was a provision in there that would have overrode state laws that ban vote harvesting. Vote harvesting is a very unwise policy. Vote harvesting, when states allow it, is a policy that says that in addition to the voter himself or herself being able to deliver their ballot or members of their family, any third-party stranger, so candidates, campaign staffers, political guns for hire, and party activists have the ability to come to your front door and say, "Hey, I'll deliver your ballot for you." You're giving people who have a stake in the outcome of the election access to your ballot. It's a very valuable commodity, and that's extremely unwise, extremely dangerous, and in fact, potentially subjects voters to coercion and pressure by these individuals at their front door. So I would not be in favor of that. There's a reason why the founders put into it to allow states to administer their own elections. And we don't need, I think, the same rule being dictated by Washington for the entire country. And then I said, I apologize, but I've got to go. I've got a deadline for something else. But I do appreciate the invitation tonight, and thanks for having me.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Von Spakovsky. So, yes, Ms. Dillon, go ahead.
Well, so I agree with everything that Mr. Von Spakovsky said, but I would add, in response to Mr. Goldfeder's question, I do not favor a national election law, and not only do I not favor it, I think it is barred by the Constitution. The Constitution Elections Clause, which I have litigated successfully, gives the right to the states to have substantial sway over their elections. So had H.R. 1 passed, I think it would have been immediately challenged in the courts as unconstitutional. That said, we obviously have existing federal Let me finish. So we have two federal laws that already govern elections on a national basis. The Help America Vote Act is one, and the National Voter Registration Act is one. And, you know, the states actually receive money from the federal government to help them administer federal elections. And so I do think it is appropriate for the federal government to condition federal funding support for elections in the states on compliance with certain minimum standards and norms. So if you are a state that has random requirements and your vote might count more in one county than the other, maybe you don't get as much federal funding as a state that is well run and organized. If your voter rolls, and this is a problem, by the way, in both red and blue states, are bloated, inaccurate, completely out of date with reality, you should not obtain matching funds. I mean, this is the same way that our federal government was able to get a speed limit, which was, you know, sort of heavily disputed, passed in the states. I know this is controversial, but sure, I think it is appropriate for the federal government to condition receipt of federal money. But no, I do not think that we can have a standard. I personally would love to see a ban on ballot harvesting. I would love to see a national voter ID. I would love to see these things be done nationally, but my federalist inclination suggests that that should not be done on a top-down basis, and rather it should be by persuasion amongst the voters.
Well, we agree that the under the Constitution, Congress has the authority to pass election laws relating to federal elections. We've had any number of them. You just mentioned some of them. So the question then becomes, is there a middle ground whereby we can enact standard laws that on a bipartisan basis, so that elections would be more transparent, they would be less open to allegations, bogus or not, and a way to make our system work more smoothly?
Well, we agree to disagree. So
I'm not sure what we're disagreeing about, because you yourself have just said we do have federal laws for certain in certain areas relating to our elections. And I think they've worked pretty well. Maybe we should have a federal law relating to absentee ballots or early voting or a variety of other facets relating to registration rules or ID rules and so on, because then it would be clear to all Americans what the rules are. The states would know what to carry, what laws they have to carry out. It would act as a disincentive for any litigation, especially last minute litigation. It's a thought that Republicans and Democrats really ought to take seriously. Simply as a result of this election, we see all this contentious activity in the courts that were not necessarily very productive. We could avoid it if we had some national standards.
So here's the audience question, maybe in a similar vein, but I liked what it said about, what about a uniform law modeled on, you know, something like the UCC that would be a project that states could adopt on their own?
Well, I like this idea. And in fact, I'm actually already working on something like this with the Republican National Lawyers Association. And in the course of the last few weeks, I've been calling state political officials because of an RNC race. And I've gotten a lot of input from people about their concerns. And so there is a request out there, at least on the right side of the aisle, for model legislation that can be passed. I mean, what is... For me, again, as a partisan, to be very transparent, one of the tragedies here in this situation has been that, and I just think from a political science perspective, whenever you have a state that's all one side or the other and there's little competition in that regard, you get bad laws. And I think we've seen that here in this election. And so we have some bad laws in red states. We have some lazy officials in those states. And of course, we have it in blue states as well. And so I think if we had some sort of some model rules, and then states can pick and choose and adjust as to what's good for them or not, we would get more consensus through the natural small d democratic federalist process.
So after you've finished contacting your colleagues, call me up, call us up. Maybe there's room for agreement.
Sure.
Maybe I'll just ask a very targeted question about mail-in balloting, since that's been something that both sides of this discussion have disputed about the integrity of that. But I guess starting with you, Harmeet, and then Jerry, what is a specific reform for the provisions of mail-in balloting, absentee balloting, that you would most like to see for the next election?
Well, I mentioned one, which is you have to have clean voter rolls. There has to be no tolerance for dead people and people who have moved, who are already on the national move people who've moved registry, they should not be on your role. But I think the other part of that I would say is we have to have uniform norms. We cannot have signature matching requirements that are waived in one county and that are very strictly applied without a cure allowance. And so I'm a fan of curing. We have a curing law in California. The curing law, interestingly, only applies to elections like the one that we just had. It does not apply to ballot measures. So right now I just signed I signed a ballot measure to recall my governor. There's no cure right there. So if the state doesn't like my signature and they say it doesn't match, too bad, Harmeet will never find out. My signature will just never matter. That's undemocratic, a small d. And so I think we ought to have a right to make sure that our votes count as much as possible. And there should be a process for that.
So I'll just say two things. We just instituted in New York a cure procedure for the very first time. And I think it worked very well. And I'm in favor of that. And you mentioned Florida earlier on. And one of the reasons why we had such we knew what the result in Florida was so quickly is because Florida has a good law with regard to counting absentee ballots, that they could count them before Election Day. They don't have to wait. And I would like to see that occur across the board as well.
And maybe just very generally, we'll finish with this. If you were the monarch who could make, not just in the mail-in context, but in any other kind of context, Jerry already mentioned things about the Electoral Count Act, but there's one thing specifically that you would encourage people to think about as a targeted reform, what would that be? Harmeet?
That's really hard. And so I would have to say if there's one thing, I have to go back to mail-in balloting. I would ban ballot harvesting. I think it is open to too much abuse, particularly of the elderly and vulnerable, and we should not have that.
Jerry?
We could start with abolishing the Electoral College.
Well, okay. That'll be our next debate, the Electoral College, although there have been debates on that, including at the National.
There have been 700 attempts to abolish or modify the Electoral College. So maybe I'm whistling in the wind.
Well, can I add one more? I think we need better politicians. We need better laws in this country.
We have some excellent politicians. And we have a lot of excellent public officials. Who put our country first, who put the people first. And those are the people we should embrace and extol and be happy about. It's hard being a public official. And we should be happy that we have people stepping up to the plate to run for office.
Well, on that hopeful note, I want to once again thank the Federalist Society for sponsoring this event, to Lou and Jenny Mahoney for their work putting it together behind the scenes. I want to thank our panelists, of course, for their contributions to this, and all of you for attending this CLE event, this webinar. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.